Hello, podcast listeners. My name is Christopher Patterson. I am an assistant professor at the New York Institute of Technology here in Nanjing, China, and I am the host of this podcast, New Books in Asian American Studies. Today, we are joined by Win Jin, who is an associate professor of English at Fudan University in Shanghai. We will discuss her book, Pluralist Universalism, an Asian Americanist critique of U.S. and Chinese multiculturalisms, which was published by Ohio State Press in 2012. Pluralist Universalism compares histories and modes of multiculturalism in China and the United States, whereas many see few correlations between China's ethnic policies and the multiculturalist policies of the U.S., Win Jin brings these narratives and histories together to show their common themes in attempting to incorporate diverse bodies into a state project and in making their respective countries seem exceptional in their tolerance and acceptance of diverse peoples. Win Jin thus offers a rich comparative study of multiculturalism that allows reader to see its more tangible form rather than to see one as superior to the other. Win Jin does this by reading literary narratives that feature a double critique in that they are critical of both the U.S. and China in using their supposed diversity of minority peoples in order to justify and rationalize state power. Ultimately, pluralist universalism provokes forms of conciliatory or official multiculturalism and leads us to question the very identity politics that has formed the basis of globalization in the 21st century. So that was my own take on the book. Win Jin, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Oh, that was a wonderful summary, better than I could have done.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. Could you begin the interview by telling us a bit about what brought you to study the histories of multiculturalism in China and the U.S. and your personal interest in Asian American studies?
Sure, I'd love to. So I was born in China, and then I went to college in China, in Shanghai. So I didn't go abroad. I didn't, you know, have any notion of going abroad until quite late. So then after I finished my BA in English, I went on to do a PhD in English at Northwestern in the U.S. And so I finished my degree in 2006, and that's when I got a job at Columbia University as an assistant professor in English. And so I guess when I first arrived in the U.S., I clearly had my moments of cultural shock, but it's more of a shock of seeing my own culture in a different light. So I realized how people have different perspectives on my own culture, on where I'm coming from. So that was a really eye-opening experience. And also, of course, I became a racialized being in the U.S., and so much of my experience has informed my entry into the field of Asian American literature. And when I was at Northwestern, I was lucky to have a few excellent Americanists on the faculty in the English department. So my dissertation was co-chaired by Dorothy Wong, you know, who is a great Asian American literary scholar, with Betsy Urquhart. And so they gave me much help in helping me come up with a topic that I was uniquely suited to do. So I think that Asian American literature just gave me a critical vocabulary to put my experiences, the changes in my ways of thinking in the U.S. in critical terms. And so it spoke to my, the field spoke to my personal feelings. And also it was, you know, in the late, in early 2000s, the field of Asian American studies was on the ascent, was sort of in its heyday. So it was quite natural that I was drawn to it. And so I wrote my dissertation on Chinese American fiction. At that time, when I was entering the field, very few scholars in Asian American literature were versed in Asian languages, or they very few incorporated Asian language literature into the purview of Asian American literature. When I was, you know, doing my project on Chinese American fiction, I included archives that no one had worked on before, archives or writings in Chinese. So I used this paradigm of diaspora to discuss Chinese American fiction. And then, of course, when I started my job at Columbia, and I liked the dissertation, but then after a while, it seemed a little narrow to me. The framework, the conceptual framework, the framework that I was using in my dissertation started to seem a little limiting. Because I was arguing in my dissertation that Chinese American authors, they figure a kind of double vision, or a double perspective in their writings. So there are they're likely to intertwine Chinese and American histories and different perspectives that they're exposed to on these two national histories. So they have a binocular vision, so to speak, right, in their writings. But then I realized that I want to look more deeply at the context, the national context that they brought together that interweave in their works. So I realized that I want to understand more how ethnicity, race, and multiculturalism have different genealogies in separate national contexts.
Okay, so this book isn't based on your dissertation, or it's brought forth through the development of your dissertation?
Well, yeah, it's a radical departure from what I was doing in my dissertation, even though I think it responds to some of the seminal questions I was raising in the dissertation. So I would say it's a radical revision.
Okay.
Of my, old work.
That's really interesting. And it feels like it comes out of that, the transnational turn in a lot of ways, but doing it in a way that's much more capable linguistically than a lot of other transnational projects. So we are both currently living in China right now, so it's kind of interesting to read this. We're talking about the U.S. is over there. The one thing that I often hear from both Chinese and like foreign expatriates in China is that China has no race problem at all in comparison to the United States. And the proof that people seem to offer up is that China is over 90% Han Chinese, and that ethnic minorities live in autonomous regions. This seems to be getting less easy to say this now with more Uyghur kind of events happening and Tibet becoming ever more kind of in the news. But this would also, it seems like the comparison would be near impossible or just extremely difficult. And I think you bring them both types of multiculturalism together. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, and how counterintuitive this project can be. And what you said is one side of the coin, and the other side is, China is seen as an authoritarian state, so it's inconceivable that it has something comparable to liberal multiculturalism, right? So there are different reasons to doubt the feasibility or the legitimacy of bringing these two systems together. So I understand that, but I think that's partially what I was trying to go against in doing this project. I wanted to see that the two things, the two genealogy, two histories that might seem very disparate to each other, and I do want to expand our understanding of multiculturalism. I don't think that it has to be rooted in liberal political theory. It can have other origins, intellectual origins, and political origins as well.
I think one thing that ties them together throughout the book is how both countries kind of use the other as a foil in order to establish like why their way of dealing with minorities and minority rights is the better one. I teach multicultural literature in China, so I'm teaching about American slavery, yellow peril, Latino immigration, and my Chinese students, I often have to push against the fact that this is not just further evidence that America is like represents disharmony and China then represents social harmony. That's often what a lot of the essays that I see is kind of just like, well, this is more proof that China has more harmony and the U.S. does not. And then I remember kind of hearing the same when I bring up, the Tibetan situation in the United States, so that Americans kind of see this as just more proof that their system is better. And I think one of the really nice things about your book is you were constantly working through this pressure to identify one mode as more better than the other, given this kind of this political situation.
I think this is the myth that China doesn't have ethnic problems is a myth, right? I mean, it has been more and more punctured in recent years, as you mentioned, right? Ethnic riots in Uyghur areas in Xinjiang and also in Tibet, and also this rising the feeling of being unsettled by the Muslim population and the religious issues in China, especially after all the military disturbance, turbulence in Central Asia, right? So it's all those issues are coming to the fore in the political consciousness of present day Chinese. So I don't think anyone can now deny that there is ethnic conflict, so there are ethnic tensions and conflicts in China. But what you said about how this denial works, right, this mechanism of denial and projecting the worst side of ethnic conflict onto the other nation, you know, so that's also something that you always observe. You know, we were talking in recent times, there was Ferguson event, right, and the coming down of a black suspect in the town of Ferguson, right? So that incident, of course, aroused much interest. So many of them were sort of critiquing, right, racial injustice in America. But at the same time, there are also many cultural incidents and events in China in right now that are reminding us of ethnic discordance right here at home. The movie version of Wolf Totem just came out recently, and so that movie also raised much controversy about how the Mongol culture is misrepresented in the movie and also in the original novel on which the movie is based, right? The novel authored by a Han writer. So there are issues like that continue to crop up and sort of unsettle this complacency among certain Chinese about us not having any problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it, one thing that shot out to me about your history of Chinese multiculturalism was how drawn it was from the Soviet context, which to me I knew very little about, and so it was quite interesting seeing a type of multiculturalism that grew out of conceptions of ethnicity and identity from a more Soviet context. And I remember also in the book you go through a fascinating kind of marginal history of how the Han identity was constructed before this, kind of as a response to colonialism and things like this, whereas I suppose it's so easy to be kind of taken in with the idea that this Han identity is like, 5,000 years old and all this, but that it was shaped very politically throughout the 20th mm-hmm. century. Can you explain a bit about the Chinese context and that history that I and most of Americans are very unfamiliar with?
I sort of offer a synopsis of the history of how the idea of ethnicity was constructed in Chinese history, especially in the 18th and 19th century, right, during the Qin Dynasty, and then in the 20th century during Republic China and Communist China. As you mentioned, the Soviet connection, I remember saying in the book that the PRC, right, so they borrow from the Soviet Union notions or definitions of ethnicity, which were in turn borrowed from German ethnologists and political theorists from the 19th century, like Louis Henry Morgan and Engels, right? People like that. And so the idea of ethnicity really came through a very complicated and torturous route, right, before it reached China and the PRC.
So
I'm not an expert in history, but even before the PRC, right, during the Qin Dynasty, and as scholars like Pamela Crossley have pointed out, the ruling Manchus, they instituted a hierarchy of different ethnicities to facilitate their rule over majority and ethnic majority, the Han majority. So indigenous conceptions of ethnicity and race in Chinese, it would be so indigenous formulations of these concepts from Western conceptions.
Do you think it would be fair, like in these comparative histories, that one thing that as an American jumps out is the kind of top down result of attempts at social control that the PRC kind of seems to represent, and then the narrative, at least, of U.S. multiculturalism as being kind of a bottom up, grassroots organizing thing, that we get through the civil rights discourse. Is that just my American perspective influencing that difference, or is there some truth, do you think, to that?
I wouldn't describe the U.S. model as a bottom-up, the Chinese as a state-sponsored model. But I believe that it can be, this is a binary thinking, can be prevalent among, or can have some appeal for some people. Well, you know, first of all, the civil rights movement is not a completely bottom-up movement. And you know, it's, along the way, it was appropriated by the state, right, or coded in laws in civil rights, you know, sort of in legal ordinances, in statutes, in official policies. I wouldn't, you know, describe affirmative action as a state-sponsored policy, but it was, you know, it was partially supported by the state, and it was also embraced by public institutions like many universities in the U.S. and other employers, or private, both the public and the private sector. So public policies like that played a major role in U.S. In the U.S. Model of multiculturalism as well. So I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't pit these two models against each other in this very rigid fashion. And also to social mobilization or social activism, right? Social activism has a longer, deeper history in the U.S. I would completely agree with that. Even though, I mean, things are definitely changing since now we have a more robust public sphere in China, right, with many sort of on the web, on the internet, or in other formats. So I'm sure those public sphere discussions will have some impetus for political changes as well, or have some effect on how public policies are formed in China. And I would also have to say that the process in which, you know, China formed its public policies is also much more complicated than many might assume.
Mm-hmm. I think your book does a great job of showing how, you know, even that question that I asked was just so loaded with, like, assumptions about one being much less free than the other and all these things. But there are some other very interesting similarities in the context that you go over. The both countries are kind of post-colonial in some ways. But they are definitely nowadays both imperial, and that seems to work kind of at the background of your text. But I was wondering if there's a sense here that the multiculturalism that they espouse in both cases either enables or kind of creates the conditions for imperial projects, whether related to capitalism, tourism, militarism, cultural influence. Did you see much of a relationship there in both of them taking this kind of multicultural identity and then how it relates to the outside world as an empire?
Yeah, I think this is one of the central issues I discussed in regard to some of the figures and texts in my book. I mentioned the wolf totem, and that's the central text. You know, the most cultural, the rhetoric of ethnic integration, right? You know, how the Han Chinese or cultural elements of Han Han Chinese culture, they need to be integrated, they need to be together, because that will create a better race, right? A better Chinese race, or a better, bolster Chinese nationalism. One of the implicit sort of meanings in this novel is a more muscular version of Chinese nationalism based on the fusion of different ethnic cultures. So that clearly is a case in which, as you were saying, right, how multiculturalism is placed in the service of national expansion and different versions of imperialism. And even in the case of Alex Crowe, right, his novel Panda Diary is also gestures towards that. You know, he is, in fact, in the book, he's drawing a conceptual linkage between the westward movement and the grand project of West development, or, you know, the development of West in China. The project seems to have similar implications for indigenous populations, for those who are forced into this process of modernization. And so, as you were saying, the modernization, colonization are intellectual corollaries, corollaries of ethnic integration. So in many cases, ethnic integration is simply a cover for a more, you know, worse, you know, far worse things that happen.
Just so our listeners understand, the novel you're talking about, The Wolf Totem, is that Jian Rong's 2004 novel, translated in 2008 as The Wolf Totem. I just wanted to make that clear. So my next question is actually on the literature that you go over, so it's a good segue here. Because you are a literary scholar, and your main method here is to analyze narratives concerning ethnicity and race in both the U.S. and China. Can you tell us a bit about how the literary narratives enable you to make this analysis, and on metaphor as a gateway to this comparison, or on your other method of double critique, that you read these narratives as critiquing both China and the U.S., and how you employ that as a method of reading?
Literature is a wonderful thing to look at because it always has access. It always has things that seem to be gratuitous, that don't seem to make much sense or that don't contribute to a solid political reading. But these moments of access are in fact perhaps the most illuminating moments in this text. So to use Panda Diaries as an example again. Right. Even though this book is, the main plot is pretty clear, and it has a character named Gula, who is a recurrent character in Alex Crowe's writings. He is a person, citizen, and he has memories of the Cultural Revolution with his parents or exiled to minority regions in China. But he also lives in current day, in present day China, where he has, he makes commentaries on contemporary political situations in China. So the main plot might be clear, but first of all, the plot is not presented in a linear fashion. It's chaotic in all sorts of ways, and incorporates not just fictional narratives about this character, but also narrative intrusions upon. On the part of the narrator, snippets of news. But more importantly, it also has a really strange character, a panda who talks, who speaks, who befriends the protagonist, and who offers his perspective on the world as an animal. So then this novel is also by including this animal figure, then starts to link racism and ethnic exclusion and nationalism to a whole different issue, which is the discrimination of the human domination over animals. So that would be, so he's making really a broader argument about how there is a certain way of thinking, right, in human beings that dictates and how they view the natural world and how they achieve dominance over the natural world as well as the weaker races. By extrapolating from those moments, those kind of enigmatic moments in the text, I'm able to make larger and broader political arguments that are not limited to making political critiques or interventions in U.S. and Chinese histories. But it's then becomes possible to point out that the national expansion also has implications for human relationships with the natural world. And there is affinity between how we relate to the natural other and how we relate to the ethnic or the racial other. So there are examples like that that show the power of literature in enriching arguments. But also, this entire project was stimulated by, or it was inspired by those literary works. I didn't have an argument, and then forced this argument into all those texts. But it was in fact the argument was in fact teased out of my engagement with these works. Mm-hmm. I also mentioned in a different chapter. Yan Guoling's novel, Food Sound. And also there's another text, you know, a Chinese Muslim author, right, Chen Chengqi, in his book, Soul, A History of the Soul, which documents 17th century China. So all those things, I think they're really the foundation of my conceptual framework. They're not just examples, but they're the foundation of that framework.
Mm-hmm. Since we spoke so much about Alex Kuo, could I ask you about that chapter now? That's chapter 3, where you look at his work, and you argue that he, as you say, he does yoke together all these different things, the environmentalism, the animals, with the Chinese ethnic minority history, but he also puts them in conversation with Native American history and Native Americans.
Oh, yeah.
So what do we gain from that kind of metaphorical comparison?
Yeah, that was a great question, because it reminds me of when it came out, of course, in around 2006. I'm sure Alex Kuo wasn't thinking about real political debates in China at the time, but at that time, when this project of developing China's West, right, or the development of China was underway, and so there were many discussions among Chinese intellectuals about how this expansion, right, relates to or compares to 19th century actual discussions and political discourses around this comparison. But this comparison was already prefigured in Alex Kuo's novel. And what you mentioned, the idea of indigeneity and how that applies, you know, for Kuo at least, right, applies equally to Chinese minorities and U.S. Native American population. I think it needs to be that coral, because there is a real connection of Chinese minorities, at least part, a few groups of Chinese minorities. They are just like indigenous populations in the Americas, right? They have an ancestral claim to the land that they inhabit. They have a longer history with the land than the Han Chinese who later come to their regions, who later came to their regions. So by, you know, by standard definitions of indigeneity, you can definitely include some ethnic groups in China in that category. So, but of course, the Chinese are never, or those minorities are hardly ever discussed in the context of indigeneity. So in this case, it's another case of, you know, of constructing a sort of a kind of weak universal of divergent histories like the U.S. and China, right? So it's a part of my larger intellectual goals in this book is to construct a kind of critical universalism, right? So I'm not saying that everything applies equally to these two histories, to these two contexts, but one has to have a certain alternative to that universalism. We need to be able to talk about countries with different political systems, with different cultural traditions within one coherent analytical framework, or otherwise there wouldn't be any meaningful dialogue.
I mean, it feels like by doing that, you're also resisting that binary model that you were talking about, where it's in the interests of both states to see them as so completely different. And here you're tracing the kind of metaphorical comparisons here in a very rich way, and it really provokes a lot of questions, like how, you know, what could a settler colonial universalism kind of look like if we were to take that, like, that model of analysis and throw it into China and see, like, what does it mean for Han Chinese to be kind of settler colonialists? But you did mention this critique of universalism here, and this brings me to the title of your book, which I probably should have asked you about earlier, the Pluralist Universalism as the title of your book. And I'm also familiar with a lot of comparative multiculturalist projects, and there's so many different, like, terms for multiculturalism, official multiculturalism, critical, socialist, liberal multiculturalism, and all this. But then you kind of offer pluralist universalism as something a bit different. Can you explain your thinking behind that term and all those other multiculturalist terms?
There is probably a better way of titling my book. So Pluralist Universalism definitely is not the best choice that I could have come up with. But, you know, first books are... So this idea, I took that idea from an Indian scholar, philosopher theorist, Bhikkhu Kharak. All right, so he has this book, Rethinking Multiculturalism, where he raises this term to describe a central tension within multiculturalism, or a central tension that undergirding multiculturalism, which is that multiculturalism has to uphold universal citizenship, right? You know, it has to defend or to create equal rights for different ethnic groups, for different communities, equal access to resources, to political power. So it has to, maintain this notion of republican citizenship. Then any form of multiculturalism, whether official or critical, has to somehow juggle a set of conflicting demands. Imperative, right? So the difference between official multiculturalism and the more critical forms of that is simply, you know, how much weight you put on difference, whether you see difference as a value in itself, or whether difference is just something that ultimately can or should be subsumed under sameness or identity. So I use this term to indicate this unending tension, the unceasing tension within any multicultural project. And I'm trying to say that this term, like any sort of any political term, can be interpreted in different ways. When people can take this term and then take that term into their own hands and turn it into a critical tool as well. But it can serve the interests of the government or state interests. So it's a term that's sort of up for grabs, it can be interpreted in more of the open to interpretation, but it also suggests toward that essential tension. How it compares to other ways of studying multiculturalism, I'm not entirely sure about that question. I just think that, multiculturalism is it's present in the subtitle, so I can't just use that word again in the main title. So the main title has to be meaningful but not repetitive. So then I came up with pluralist universalism, and as I was saying, you know, I was always interested in tackling this idea of critical universalism, how we can imagine cultural or social alliances that do not erase differences, that in fact center on valuing differences. So I was always interested in that question. So I guess that went unconsciously into the title of the book.
Well, you especially kind of flesh out this term. And I'm going to skip through, I feel like we answered almost all the questions that I had for the chapters, besides the fifth chapter, which is actually more on this concept of pluralist universalism. When you're reading Yan Geling's 1996 novel, Fu Song, translated in 2001 as Lost Daughter of Happiness. And in that chapter, you show how the novel attempts to call attention to the conditions needed for an ideal form of multiculturalism, and I might be mistaken, but it feels like that ideal form of multiculturalism could be this pluralist universalism that you're speaking about, or that it calls attention to the conditions needed for this, as to say that the conditions are almost impossible to actually produce this. Can you explain a bit what you're doing in that chapter and how it kind of extrapolates on this idea of pluralist universalism?
It was what you were saying, that ideal multiculturalism is a pretty impossible notion, just as this novel, and this is a pretty impossible novel. And this novel, written by Yan Geling, right? Yan Geling is an immigrant, a Chinese immigrant writer. She now, I think, lives permanently in the U.S., but sometimes goes, comes back to China to give talks and lectures. She is a very prolific writer. And I believe that Fu Song is one of her favorite works by herself. So this work depicts a Chinese prostitute in the 19th century in San Francisco Chinatown. So as we were, you know, as we all know, you know, Chinatowns in 19th century America do have those prostitutes. You know, they bring Chinese women into their communities, and many of those women, but you know, some of them are marriage merchants, of course, but many of them do then become prostitutes. So it's largely based on real history of 19th century Chinatown. But in any case, but then how the story plays out then is completely counterintuitive, because this prostitute, the story about her doesn't focus on her misery, on her suffering, on how she is exploited by other men in Chinatown or by other members of community, but it's really about how she has this, cultivates this extreme, perhaps unconsciously, but this extremely stoic attitude towards being exploited, being sexually used. She completely opens herself up to anyone who visits her, and she develops this very unique relationship with a white boy, Chris, right? A white teenager. Boy who develops a crush on her. So the story depicts an impossible woman. But for me, it really connects, right? This novel and its approach to this character connects to all relationships or sexual acts are often seen as a way of affirming the self or affirming or bolstering the ego. Whereas, as Bassani points out, it can also be turned into a process of shattering the ego, of merging, of tearing down the differences or the divisions between self and other. So if you think of a completely new psyche, a completely new attitude toward otherness. And so I'm arguing that Yingling's novel is radical in that way, right? So it creates an impossible character who embodies this most idealized notion of sexuality. And I believe that it really, that the novel can be read or can be construed to delve into the question of psychic conditions for the kind of ideal multiculturalism that I'm trying to call into being.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my take on,
It is fascinating, too, that ideal multiculturalism, in a sense, comes at such expense and under economic duress, and the openness is such a sexual openness and throughout the novel. It's so rich in those kind of themes. I suppose like all of Jan Gilding's work is. Wenjin, we've taken up a lot of your time. Can you tell us about any new research that you've been working on? What's the next step after this book? And it was written in 2012 or in 2012, so I bet you've been mulling a lot over the next projects.
Yeah. I've been thinking about what the next steps. So in my first book, I'm interested in intellectual or genealogies of ideas. So I started to move a bit away from political concepts. Now I'm more interested in structures of feeling and how our attitudes toward privacy or individualism or public spheres, and how our sentiments around those ideas can also change over time, and also have very specific contexts and implications. So now, I've moved a bit into affect studies or emotion studies, but still in a comparative framework. So I recently put on an early 20th century Chinese novel, which sort of borrowed from a sentimental fiction, produced in in America. So in that essay, I looked at how the Chinese translation of Uncle Tom's Cabin, right, in the beginning of the 20th century gave rise to sentimental fiction written in Chinese. So I think my new project, as in general, to continue my experimentation with comparative readings in my in my first book, but just sort of broaden my inquiry into histories of feelings. So that's sort of one piece of this new direction that I'm moving into. And also, I also finished another, which is coming out, but I also finished another essay on sort of end of on the much more recent text, Karen Kiyamashita's novel *I Hotel*, which documents the beginning of the Asian American movement, right, between 1968 and 1978. So I also sort of put that novel in conversation with theories of emotions and cognition, and see how this novel suggests a different way of thinking about ethnic movements and communities. So in addition to working on 20th century texts, I'm also backpedaling a little bit into to see how modern understandings of of things like privacy and the public sphere started originated in the 18th century, and so I also started to compare 18th century Chinese novels produced from the late Ming Dynasty, which would be the 16th and 17th century. So then, so in that project, I wanted to I want to look at sort of beginnings of modern feelings or modern structures of feeling in Chinese and English contexts, and how they went on similar paths but also diverged in different ways. So in other words, I think my investments in comparative work has sort of taken me into two different directions, right? Sort of a 20th century of studies of 20th century structures of feeling, but also how those structures of feeling originated in an earlier point in time.
Okay, yeah, that sounds fascinating. It sounds like a very almost natural follow-up to this book, actually. I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you for all the incisive questions. Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to my interview with Win Jin on her book, Pluralist Universalism. If you have any questions, grievances, or suggestions for books for this podcast, you can message me on the New Books in Asian American Studies Facebook page. See you next time.